I'm Jamal, and you're listening to Guess in the Mecha, your weekly anime and manga analysis podcast. From inspiring arcs to game-changing cinematography, I'm on a journey to try and make sense of it all, episode by episode. Enjoy the show. Welcome back to another episode of Guess in the Mecha, and a very sincere welcome back, since it has been quite a while since we've done this, I might as well say that. It's been a while. Of course, I had to take some time out to, I guess, like, finish some other life-related things, but now, hopefully, the show is back on the road for real now. And to do that, we're gonna start by, ironically, talking about anime in which I've missed or didn't get the opportunity to talk about. This is usually the point of the year in which I do a mid-year review, in which I like to discuss things in which have already come out at that point in the year, and sort of sound off on those, but I feel like it's a bit weird if I kind of skipped everything which I had the opportunity to talk about. And if I'm going to be real, it's the only content I had prepared up to this point that I had written in that period. So we're going to do that. We're going to talk about 2022 anime. And more specifically, I'm not going to talk about the stuff in which you probably already know. I don't want to waste anyone's time talking about, you know, like Bocchi the Rock for the 50th time, since I'm sure everyone knows how great that show among many others are. But I want to talk about some of the things you might have missed, or things in which I think are still worth going back to in 2023, even though, you know, of course, 2022 in the fast-paced seasonal landscape that we know is, you know, is long gone, so to speak. And hopefully that should, at least in a season and year that perhaps is a bit drier than I expected, hopefully that will give you something to watch as well, if those are things that are, you know, or if those were things that were gaps perhaps in your watch list. So without further delay, let's jump right back into this whole podcast thing. That is episode 118, a look at 2022 anime from a bit of a delayed perspective. I should kind of address why I'm discussing 2022 anime a bit more. Of course, there are the practical reasons, which I mentioned, being that I haven't covered anime in a long time. I haven't even been watching as much anime as I perhaps should have over the last year so far, or at least the past like 6 months. However, I still think this is worth covering, because from what I have seen of 2023 anime, and I've been playing like a lot of catch up over the last few weeks, it's fine, at least for me so far. I'm sure there are some big things coming, and I know there are some big things coming, primarily in the film space though, I would say. But there hasn't been, besides maybe one or two things, there hasn't really been anything that's really like blown my socks off yet, in the way that perhaps 2022 anime had quite a few of those. And of course, maybe one of my favorite anime years ever, 2021, which I really do need to address in another video or episode sometime. For 2022, as we discussed a few episodes ago, like 2 episodes ago, though that was quite a long time ago, was really a season to remember. That season, wall to wall, was just incredible. So many great things. And I think inevitably, coming off that high, it was gonna feel a bit awkward. It was gonna feel a bit weird having shows that were, yeah, we had a few good shows here and there, this year so far, but it just wasn't going to feel as stacked, I suppose, as what we just passed, just by nature of contrast. That's just how things are. And that's why I think talking about 2022 anime, it's surprisingly timely, because I feel like I can perhaps fill some gaps for maybe some people that want to go back and experience some things that are still new and perhaps relevant, you can argue, but still give them, I guess, a sense of excitement and think something to look forward to as well. So that's why I'm covering this here, outside of, I guess, the more practical things. So let's talk about shows first. And funnily enough, this isn't even a TV anime. It's still a show and a series nonetheless. But from everything I understand, it was streaming only. And that is Tatami Time Machine Blues. And I just want to say, like, I find it really weird that in a list in which I'm talking about things that perhaps might have been skipped over and are very worth going back to in case you missed, I'm talking about the Tatami Galaxy. This is part of, I have a whole spiel about how Disney Plus, at least outside of Japan, really did a rubbish job on marketing when it came to this show and kind of just dropped it very like shortly after it aired in Japan, very quietly without really doing much of the work to build the hype for a property that is in fact very good and worthy of many people's attention. I really found that quite weird that I have to, you know, mention Tatami Time Machine Blues, because to some people, they didn't even know this show existed, which is a very weird timeline to be in. It's also quite funny that I'm talking about Shingo Natsume over 1 year later after, you know, the extensive Sonny Boy coverage we did. And I guess that just says a lot about how versatile he is as a creative. Not only, you know, making a smash hit original, at least in my opinion, but also just really being able to adapt to the old stuff he was on. Of course, he was on the original Tatami series, both on Night is Short and the main TV show. And so him being able to come back many years later, well, I guess not many years because of Night is Short, but being able to come back and still really add his own spin to a series in which he was a part of, I think says a lot of about how great he is as a creator and just how versatile he is, as I mentioned. I think in the anime community, and understandably, there's a slight fear when people see that the director for a show that they really like and is really beloved is being changed out for another one. And while I understand that, and of course the facts regarding Natsume don't quite add up to that logic because he was on those other shows, I understand that. But that being said, I think if anything, Natsume directing it is what makes it very worth watching. Obviously, now we can look at this in hindsight or from a review perspective. What I really liked about it was Natsume's slightly more slower paced approach to things, whereas I think Yuasa is much more frantic. It's about getting in all those details. And admittedly, that makes a lot of sense for the Tatami Galaxy's main series. It's mostly about overthinking and kind of clearing out that noise eventually and understanding that, you know, you can kind of be content with what you have and who you are, etc. Whereas in Time Machine Blues, I think this series is, well, one, of course, it's about being in Japanese summertime and everyone's very slow and bogged down by the heat. And so I think that really matches it too. But also I think it's a much more reflective show. Tatami Time Machine Blues in a lot of respects reflects on what happens in the Tatami Galaxy. And so I think having a bit more of a slower pace to things is quite nice. It's also about time as well. And so having that slower pace to reflect on the times in which we move to and all these different memories and so on that we experience as we go back in time in some respects is worth having, I think. Another reason why, again, in hindsight, that I think the show is really worth watching is just how, once again, different it is. And I mean that from the perspective of staff as well. Like, two of the people I've pointed to before are Moku-chan and Fugi Yamashiro. Two incredible directors. Both those episodes have their own unique spins to them. I know the Yamashiro episode maybe isn't one that I think everyone will be fond of, but I respect the attempts to do different things with it. And that's what I quite like a lot. And then the Moku-chan episode, of course, Moku-chan being a part of the Heikei team, I was immediately drawn to that. And yeah, this episode doesn't disappoint. All their very specific things that they do, i.e. the way they work with stills, is there and very strong. So if for some reason you're putting off Tatami Time Machine Blues because, you know, it was a bit too out there for you and too different, at least from like a name's perspective, then I'd hop right in because there's no better time to watch it. It's great. And it's also summertime as well. So yeah, it's a great time to watch this show. Let's talk about films and shorts and music videos and that sort of stuff. The stuff that I think is much more easily sidelined, and for good reason, at least I'd say films specifically, just because the release of those are either much delayed or just quite silent or quiet. Music videos, maybe not so much because they are very accessible, but I guess just most people in the anime scene or people who enjoy anime, I don't think pursue watching music videos very much, or at least, they don't view it as part of their regular, like, watching regimen, which is fine, I guess. But of course, this podcast is about kind of giving you those different perspectives and those perhaps alternative things that I think are worth looking at as well. So of course, we're going to address at least a music video. But firstly, let's talk about a film, and that is going to be The Girl from the Other Side. I've spoken about Inuo already. That's like the elephant in the room when it comes to movies from 2022 for me. I love that movie. I'm just going to say that right off the bat. It's not to say that, I'm throwing Inuo under the bus or anything, but I really want to talk about this movie instead, because this is the one in which really won me over. It's my favorite movie from 2022, even though, like, coverage-wise, I haven't really spoken about one versus the other very much. The Girl from the Other Side spoke to me in just a different way, in a way that most anime and even some of my favorite filmmakers just haven't been able to do, and thus I kind of couldn't pass up discussing it here. This is technically an OVA, but based on what I've seen, it has been released and it was released at numerous film festivals and had some niche theatrical releases. It's been treated like a movie, even though its initial release was basically just as a disc. But to keep it simple, we're gonna call it a film. It also was on Crunchyroll not long afterwards, or at least it came out on Crunchyroll, I think, sometime. But then it was split into two episodes, which was really weird, and I really didn't understand, so let's just keep it simple and call it a film. We spoke about Yusuro Kubo and Satomi Maya on the 2022 Anime Preview podcast, which feels like ages ago now, even though I still remember editing that. And to be fair, I already knew that this was going to be the one, at least to me. Like, I know maybe that sounds a bit weird that, like, I wanted to like this movie and now I'm saying it's my favorite movie from here, but I guess that's just how it panned out, honestly. I did already like these filmmakers for quite a while prior to this movie even being announced. But I think the appeal of this movie for me, and I think a reason why it still shines and is worth going back to, is because of kind of what I was alluding to before and how it stands out in a way that most anime doesn't. And I think there's partially a reason for this, and that is the fact that many of the staff, including Satomi Maya and Yusuro Kubo, you can argue, although I'd say since Girl from the Other Side, ironically, they've been frequenting anime quite a bit, or at least when I say anime, or I mean more the quote-unquote central anime sphere. They don't particularly work directly in that field very regularly, or at least they target more of what I'd call the peripheries, so music videos, and in this case with some of the staff on the credits, illustration and things like that. So they take a pretty different approach, and it's very visible. Of course, that's no diss towards TV anime and films and so on, but I'd say that there is definitely an alternative approach that you can feel. It's hard to describe what that is, but it definitely doesn't feel like it's coming from perhaps a director who's been like born and bred into the anime industry as we know it, perhaps, or the anime industry that is known to most people. Even if we're talking more surface level things, stuff like the aesthetic things, the overall texture of the movie, in terms of the drawings and the scenery and the media that's used, or at least emulated, just feels so different to anything you'd ever see in a movie, on the most part, or a TV anime. Besides some very special things with like special credits. But making an entire movie like that just feels completely radical, honestly. And I think that's what really set it apart for me. It felt like someone almost denying the laws of anime and deciding to do something different. The most impressive parts of The Girl from the Other Side, although the whole movie is impressive to me, are things that I've only managed to see in the experimental space. I'm having trouble trying to categorize, as you can tell, categorize the quote-unquote experimental side of anime, because I feel like there's a bit of contention as to is it anime? And of course, you can take the approach that anime is simply Japanese animation, but you can also argue that anime has its own sort of, I guess, cultural context to it, and industrial context to it, or industry context to it. So I find that very difficult to class on where it is. I think The Girl from the Other Side is very firmly anime, at least from an industry perspective, made it, you know, the Ibaraki branch of Wit Studio. I think that's very fair to call it anime from that perspective. But when we talk about some of those other things that are on the quote unquote periphery, I do struggle to call it anime per se, not necessarily because that's not a criticism, but it's just a bit difficult. Like, just a quick anecdote, I did go to an online webinar in which, like, Koji Yamamura was speaking, someone who's also produced a lot of the work of Satomi Maya and Yutaro Kubo, as he does do that stuff at the Tokyo University of Arts. And he mentioned that what he's working on is Japanese animation and not anime. And I found that really deep, because I've never really heard that from someone working in the industry themselves, that they're not working on anime. And I didn't really feel like it was this, you know, anime is bad type deal, but it definitely felt like they were making a very intentional distinction between the two things. And I find that quite interesting. It's something that stuck with me for a long time. And so when it comes to talking about these things, I do struggle to, you know, say, is this anime? Is this on the edge of anime? Is it anime at all? But to return to The Girl from the Other Side, I still think it's very worth watching right now. I say right now as if the movie came out like 10 years ago. It came out last year. But yeah, I still think it's worth your time and slotting in to your time this season or next season, simply because I don't think you're really going to see much like this for a while, being these takes that come from, I'd say, beyond just the central anime sphere and importing them into it. Ultimately, I think this anime is just a really great and unique experience. It's a sensory experience, from its like low-key sound design and the traditional feeling texture that it evokes from its media. It's just one of those things that you have to see. And that's why I can wholeheartedly tell you to like slot this into your anime regimen, no matter whether it came out like a year ago or not. Let's shift gears to Naoko Yamada. And there's never not a good time to talk about Yamada, honestly. Especially in 2022 and 2021, because she's obviously had some massive changes in how she's putting out work these days. Obviously the Saiyan Saru stuff, but also some other stuff as well. She's been doing adverts. And in this case, in 2022, we had a short film from her. There's Gun of Remembrance as well, which came out last year, but technically haven't seen yet, or at least it hasn't been released very widely. Though from when this was recorded, it was screened at an SE, from what I understand. But in this case, we have He's Playing Our Song, which was released by her as a part of the Mon Love Tokyo series, which is basically a live action, for the most part, live action series of shorts about, you guessed it, love. Love and relationships. And so Yamada had an animated part in this as well, which, surprise, surprise, was really good, at least in my opinion. Just for clarification, the animation was not produced at Saiyan Saru, though. This was done at the Answer Studio. I can't really speak to the Answer Studio as a studio, but at least this short is very well produced. It's very good. I liked it from a technical standpoint, and it's very enjoyable. I wouldn't say it's like the most memorable part of her career. I don't think that this was intending to be that, but I think it's a nice thing, and I think it's a part of, it's definitely a showcase of her evolution. And so that's what in this case, and why I'm bringing this up. I think this is something worth looking at and going back to, especially in 2023, in which we have both Garden of Remembrance and her original movie, Kimi no Uro, coming out. This, I think, should give you a bit of, I guess, context, not because it's context for those things in particular, but I think it's a good showcase of how she is changing as a director, and what she's deciding to discuss and work with in terms of like writing. And in short, it's about a working adult woman reflecting on her secondary school, like high school life for the Americans, her high school romance, and moving on from the actions she regrets when she engaged in that very romance. It's very quintessentially Yamada in that regard. It's an emotional piece about reflection and moving on and coming to terms with things. This is a theme she's touched on many times. Heike Monogatari is perhaps the best example of this, an entire piece coming, of course, after 2019 about reflecting on the death of others and such. And so I think He's Playing Our Song obviously isn't as emotionally loaded as Heike Monogatari or perhaps A Silent Voice, but I think it's still up there with what she usually does. So I'd say it's still within that comfort zone. And I'm expecting Gun of Remembrance and Kimimoto to be quite similar in that respect, which again is what makes this, I think, a good piece of context, so to speak. Much like many filmmakers who have a comfort zone, I'd say Hosoda, for example, who explores virtual cultures extensively in numerous movies. Masayuki Miyaji, who talks about the environment and interactions with it. You can argue Shinkai has kind of been doing a similar thing, but I'd say his leans more towards the human relationships that are within these, or at least these one-on-one relationships that are caught amongst these environmental catastrophes. I'm saying that especially post Suzume, which I'm very lukewarm on, that's another subject. But I think in the case of Yamada, this, her sort of comfort zone is about nostalgia and reflection and how we engage with the past. That's the crux of a lot of her filmography, I'd argue. And He's Playing Our Song is a very fitting part of that. For that reason, I'm not surprised that she worked on this script written by Naoko Okigami, because it's just in her wheelhouse. And it's a good way of, I'd say, moving that needle in terms of what she's discussing. What that needle is, in my opinion, is really how she's discussing or portraying femininity. A lot of that, I think, has grown in age, or more, I'd say it's become more diverse. It's expanded beyond perhaps the classroom and younger women, and has expanded a bit more to talk about perhaps how older women engage with their younger selves, or at least their younger understandings of themselves, or how different ages of women engage with each other. Heike Monogatari, the relationship between Biwa and Tokuko is a good example of this. Or you can even say Biwa and her mother. He's Playing Our Song configures into this puzzle very well. And hopefully Gun of Remembrance and Kimi no Iro will richen this area much more for her, if that's even what they're about, because I haven't seen them yet, and I don't even know when I'm gonna see them, honestly. So I guess if you are like me and you are waiting for Kimi no Iro, or you're waiting for Garden of Remembrance, and you haven't seen He's Playing Our Song, I think this is a good stopgap to get a bit excited for what Yamada is cooking up in what has been cooking up lately. I'm really excited for Kimi no Iro, honestly, but I think it's just the weight that is eating at me a bit, because it's probably going to be a while since we see it, since it is slated for, I think, the end of this year from what I get. And Gun of Remembrance so far has just been circulating the film circuit. So this is the best we got right now. And yeah, I'm looking forward to it, and I highly recommend watching He's Playing Our Song this year if you are like a really big Naoki Yamada fan and you're really looking forward to what she's directing next. Another short film from last year that I think is worth going to, and now that I look at it, it's aged a bit weird, not because it's not worth checking out, but the artist who I'm covering also released another short as well not very long after this, so it's a bit strange now recommending their older short. In terms of what it actually is, I'm talking about Futaribu no Shome, which is a short directed by Loundraw at Flat Studio. I've covered most of what I wanted to say about this on my Twitter page, so I'll keep this brief and I'll probably link that thread in the show notes. But this film, and to be fair, calling this a film is a little contentious because it's technically a long-form commercial for the education company Zedkai. We'll call it a short again just to keep it simple. I wanted to mention this just because I didn't really get to talk about Loundraw very often. Loundraw perhaps is also one of those artists that is, I don't know if I'd say they're on the periphery, because they do dabble in TV anime a decent amount or here and there for certain things, but I wouldn't necessarily call them in the center, as I mentioned before. Summer Ghost, for example, was kind of a niche release, but from what I understand and from everyone who watched it, it was really well respected, and I think it's a really good movie. Futaribu no Shome is also a really heartfelt work, despite perhaps what you might expect when people hear like advert or commercial. If I wasn't told that it was for an education company, I probably just wouldn't know and wouldn't care, because of just how much is put into it, and you can really tell how much is put into it. At the time when I was writing this, there wasn't actually an English translation floating around for it, but now it's officially translated, I believe, by the company themselves. But you don't really need to even watch it in English or whatever language you do watch it in, because I think Loundraw is that good of an artist to portray what's going on without words, and says a lot about them as a visual storyteller, I suppose. The lighting and rendering based on the weather tells most of that story. The intensity of those exams and studying for them is portrayed as grey and murky, with all these navy colours brought into the picture, whereas their childhoods are given all these greens and yellows and very nice, almost, I don't say acidic colours, but almost citrus feeling colors. It's juicy and fun and exciting at that time in their school lives, and I find that contrast very interesting. Of course, it's an advert as well, so it is worth taking that in mind, that it is trying to, because by the end it's like, yeah, we made it through it and we're ready, and even though it's winter, the skies have cleared, so, you know, like, Zedkai can get you through it type stuff. So, like, yeah, it is an advert, admittedly, but I still think there is some really great storytelling going on, and so I really just wanted to give my hat off to Loundraw, and would basically say watch this in addition to their Toho short, which came out this year, as well as Summer Ghost if you haven't already, because just because it is an ad, it doesn't mean it's not good. And they have also done this before, they did it for Line as well. But yeah, I know sometimes adverts do get a rep for, oh, not being artistic because it's an ad, and I know what you're saying, I genuinely do, and I'm not like trying to shill for adverts or something, but I do think there is some artistic merit in some of these that's very worth observing, regardless of whether it's an advert or not. Which is why, again, I'm recommending Futaribu no Shome. Last but not least, let's talk about a music video, because we love music videos here, and more importantly, I want to normalize making music videos a part of anime discourse, because I think, although I'd say we're improving, I still think it's something that people leave out and don't really discuss, and I understand why, but like, in a similar way that I think music videos in general, live action music videos, animated, whatever, are equally filmmaking. Like, I think some people don't consider music videos film. In a lot of ways, I think they are and should be considered that and should be integrated into that very discussion. But anyway, the music video we're discussing is Thunder and Bud. And weirdly enough, although I put it on this list, I forgot about it for most of the year. And I think that's because it came out in the first half of 2022, which unfortunately is kind of a bad position to be in. not because it's anyone's fault, but because, of course, Fall 2022, from a TV anime standpoint, had just so much incredible stuff. And there were even a lot of like small music videos and stuff that crept in at the end of the year, like there was the Haruka Fujita project as well, that managed to sneak in just before the year ended. I'm not going to discuss that here. I don't really have enough time for that. But that year and that part of the year was crazy. So being in the early half of that year, unfortunately, I think it was a bit of a disadvantage. This is a music video for the artist Kaf and Hakushi Hagesawa, who is a musician who I've recently gotten into, actually. I think it was even before the video. But in terms of the art stuff, this is being led by Sugura Asakura and Kerr. These are artists who, admittedly, I'm not too familiar with, but I think that is the appeal of this for me. It's ultimately to us who I'm not too familiar with doing something really incredible, and now I'm, I guess, hooked onto their stuff, and I'm definitely going to try and track down more of their stuff and probably even try and integrate some of them into these episodes. I think this video, though, overall scratches an itch for me that I often raise, and it's this relationship between written ideas and technical ideas. And this piece really prospers by uniting these things together. When it's able to bring together the ideas that were written on paper and visualize them and have those visual ideas speak back to the things in which were written down, and kind of, they're almost like doing ping pong between each other. That's when I think it truly lights up. And that's something that I try to address here all the time. And Thunder in Bud is an amazing example of that in a short music video. I can't speak on the lyrics themselves, which is perhaps a bit unfortunate because I couldn't really find a reliable English translation. And the last thing I really want to do is kind of give you false lyrics to prove what I'm saying. But in terms of the premise itself from what I watched, it basically concerns the avatar of the artist Kaf tracking down their childhood stuff within their very own mind. And it goes hand in hand with the like overall creative approach of the video, which mostly leans towards a lot of morphing animation and a lot of dissolving seamlessly between these scenes from one to another, much like how the mind strings thoughts together in this very irrational fashion. And that kind of points out what I'm trying to say in summary, that the way in which this music video is directed is very irrational. And also you can argue that Hakushi Hagesawa's music, if you ever do want to take a listen to that, is very irrational too in how it's paced and how it's sung as well. It doesn't really always have this consistent pace. Sometimes it does. It's very spontaneous, and there's never usually this consistent flow that you can get into because the flow is always changing, and that's partially the appeal of his music to me. There are so many things going on at once in this music video, admittedly, but at the same time, everything flows into another. Basically, everything is one in the same, you can argue, be it like the transparency of the characters and how they were blending into one another, how the backgrounds constantly shift and become the foreground, how the foreground, vice versa, becomes the background. I don't know, it reminds me a lot of, if I'm just going to bring in something that I think people will be more familiar with, it reminds me a lot of instrumentality from Evangelion. Essentially, Shinji is able to morph into everything and anything and kind of do what he wants at some points, although you can argue whether that's his will is another question. But him morphing into all these different things is very similar to what we see here in Thunder and Bud, essentially. But I'd say Thunder and Bud kind of does it, I'd say it takes it to its more logical conclusion, partially because it is a music video, but it's also, well, I suppose it has more to work with. It's flowing with the music, it's flowing with the rhythm, and so on. And I think that once again speaks to the very like mental and cerebral feeling we get from this music video, where it's almost this question of whether the music exists within the world in which they're in, or are they separate? And I think that's what makes it, again, this very like mental psychedelic experience that can't quite be explained because it doesn't truly make sense in every respect because of those things that go unquestioned. It's kind of the magic of a music video, I guess, is being able to almost taunt the viewer for a very short period of time and almost raise all these questions that don't really need answering at all, and you can kind of just leave it there. And I really like that in Thunder and Blood. That's maybe one of the coolest qualities of it. I can't believe I'm saying this, but spoilers for a music video, I guess. Although you can watch it like right now for free. But but I think this is most interesting by the end, where the main character, Kaff, is revealed, well, Kaff the artist, is revealed to be listening to the song that we, the listener, were listening to all this time. So what I said basically is true. And I think that deepens the video much further. It doesn't feel kind of like a last minute, oh, plot twist, haha, because ultimately from the offset, it did reveal itself to be this very experimental experience in which you're not really meant to truly understand. And you still don't really understand it after that plot twist anyway. Once again, the beauty of very short form, narrow things is that you're able to raise these questions that you don't really need to answer. I think it deepens the video even further, though, because you can argue that what it's essentially saying is, it's a, I guess, reflection of the thoughts and feelings that one experiences when listening to a song like the one in the video. I know it's like pretty meta to think about, and probably would make more sense if you actually watched the video if you haven't already. But I think it just shows a really great awareness of how like written narrative, audio, and visual art are all part of the same unitary experience. None is really separate from one another. I think that's kind of why I left this last, because it leads to a really great takeaway. Because as we do mention quite a lot, I really hate this separation between stuff like, oh, like visuals aren't the story, or more like, as long as the story is good, the visuals don't matter. When it's like, no, because visual storytelling is all part of storytelling at the end of the day. Storytelling is multifaceted, it's multidimensional, and Thunder and Bud is very good proof of that and showing how those things come together. It's a very small case study of how this can be done, but it's a great example nonetheless, which is why I would like really recommend watching something like this. And just shows that this is something that people are doing and considering and taking in mind. In short, what I'm trying to say is watch Thunder and Bud, and more importantly, watch music videos. It doesn't even just have to be Thunder and Bud, but there are many artists in which you might not know. I didn't know the artist in which directed this music video until I watched it. There are going to be many music videos that you see that I think are really going to give you a different insight into what the Japanese animation scene is capable of, which in of itself I think is a great thing to do for broadening your horizons, not just, I guess, watching different shows, but watching different types of, or different formats of animation, be it music videos, be it short films, be it OVAs, etc., etc. I think this is a really good exercise, and like Thunder and Bud, I hope would be one of those things that convinces someone to go, hey, I should watch more of these, because they provide some really great experiences. So that's going to wrap it up for this episode. I really hope you did enjoy this, and hopefully I hope the video podcast doesn't turn out too awkward, because it is like over 20 degrees here in London, and I'm in a very like tight room next to a green screen and curtains, so I had to adjust the lighting a lot. And I'm like borderline sweating, so forgive me if things didn't turn out too great, but I hope things turn out okay and are watchable. As always, the links to the stuff that I mentioned will be in the show notes. Just a reminder, since I know I haven't done this for a while, the show notes are on getinthemecha.home.blog. Every time there's an episode, there's a post that goes with it. All the links will be in there. They should be in the descriptions as well to the various things. But if you want a more concise list, alongside all the ways to watch the show and stuff, all the link stuff, just go to getinthemecha.home.blog. It will save you time. And hopefully is just a good way. If you want to check out previous episodes and show notes, that's the place to go as well. As always as well, just to re-plug, you can follow me on Twitter at GetInTheMecha as well. I do lots of, I basically blog there. I talk about stuff that I like. It's a good time, hopefully. Last but not least, if you want to support the show, the best thing you can do in terms of the audio version, at least, is to give it a review and share it with a friend as well. On Apple Podcasts, I'd really appreciate it, as well as on Spotify if you left a review. Ideally, a nice review, but honestly, just give your opinion on the show. That really helps out and helps me as well, help make a better podcast overall. And then on YouTube, like, subscribe, the things that everyone tells you to do. Those are very helpful as well, of course. Anyway, that's going to call it for this episode. I hope you had a good listen. I'd love to hear what you think in the comments, social media, etc. And yeah, I'll see you hopefully on the next episode very shortly. So have a good day, and I shall see you next time.
The music in this episode goes as follows: Chill, Adventure Time Revised, On the Road Again, and Synthwave by Alex. And all this music is done by Alex McCulloch and is under the public domain.